Welcome to another broadcast of Round and About the Guggenheim. Here now is our moderator, Mimi Poser.
Good evening. This is Mimi Poser at the Guggenheim. Portraits and self-portraits, an aspect of art that has fascinated the artist, the sitter, and the viewer throughout the ages, is the subject of an exhibition titled Modern Portraits, the Self and Others, which is currently on view at the Wildenstein Galleries in New York. Consisting of over 130 paintings, drawings, and photographs, the show, which brings together many illustrious names of both the artists and their sitters, surveys the field of portraiture from 1900 to the present. The exhibition was organized by the Department of Art History of Columbia University as a benefit for their graduate research fund. With us this evening are Professor Kirk Vonnardo of Columbia University, who was in charge of the organization, and three Columbia students, Pat Siafa, Doug Brenner, and Janet Parks, who, among others, collaborated with him on both the exhibition and the accompanying catalog. Good evening and welcome to you all. I would like to begin by talking about Hilton Kramer's review in the New York Times, which incidentally was full of praise for this exhibition. In it, he remarked that portraiture, although a subject of great appeal, has in general been neglected as a subject for exhibitions. Kirk, why do you think this is so? Or do you not think it's so?
Well, I think there are two problems. For one thing, a portrait show in general is often thought of as a wall full of faces, which is thought to be relatively boring or monotonous. There's not enough variety in a portrait show, and particularly in a modern portrait show, it's felt that since modern art has primarily concerned itself with streams of abstract representation, with concepts of representation which veer away from the idea of imitation or likeness, that the portrait has become a relatively dead issue, a backwater of modern art.
Well, I think Mr. Kramer would disagree with you. He feels that the viewer coming to a portrait show comes with the advantage of recognition, the titillation of knowing anecdotal material about the sitter, or in the case of a self-portrait, about the artist.
Well, there are obvious advantages, too. I was trying to explain some of the disadvantages. No, I think that he's right in stressing that portraiture, in a sense, is what he called an impure art form, that your associations with the painting have a lot to do with your appreciation. Instead of a simple formal understanding of the painting as a visual experience, what you know about Stravinsky or Joyce or whoever else is represented has a great deal to do with your pleasure in the picture. And in fact, we banked on that fact in doing the show. That's one of the reasons that we tried to select interesting, well-known personalities as sitters, precisely to enrich that side of the experience of seeing the objects.
Then my next question was, what made you choose this subject for the exhibition?
Well, we were going to do another, we've done a series of benefit exhibitions, so it was in the cards to do another one at this time, and we'd
this
never...
This is the fifth, isn't it?
Yes, that's right, it's the fifth in the series. And we'd never done a show which focused specifically on the 20th century, and Columbia has a strong commitment to teaching modern art, and we thought it would be appropriate for the department to do a modern show. And we began with the idea of doing the revival of interest in portraiture in the late 19th century is actually how it began, and we decided to broaden our scope in order to give ourselves more leeway. And the more I broadened the scope, the more I began to feel that the really interesting issue lay in the role of portraiture, specifically in 20th century and in modern art, not still within the confines of representation in the late 19th century, but after 1900 and the big changes that took place. So that was where we decided to focus.
Now, what are the changes in portraiture, in the attitude towards portraiture in the 20th century, and what are the factors which brought about these changes?
Well, I tried to write an essay in the catalog at the beginning which suggested some of the... It's such a large subject, one could go on forever, but basically there seems to be some sort of watershed in modern art where the idea becomes no longer to create a visual imitation or likeness in portraiture, but to produce a portrait which is in some senses a substitute for, an equivalent for, the person, where the idea of likeness no longer depends on a visual correlation between the features of the person and the forms in the portrait, but some deeper correlation between the system of form represented and the system of thought of the man who is the subject, or a series of attributes which represent his interests. One begins to explore a kind of portraiture which is non-visual, which is more conceptual, and in which the artist himself comes to make almost all the decisions, so that the picture becomes primarily a Picasso before it is Gertrude Stein. And there's a shift in emphasis in the role, the dialogue between the artist and the sitter.
Well, that's a subject I'd like to talk about more a little bit later. The second part of my question was, what factors do you think brought about these changes in not only the attitudes but in the the techniques were a factor of the change in art itself, but what were the factors that brought about this change in attitude towards the portrait?
Well, the portrait followed larger changes in art. The idea of likeness is, after all, not something which was restricted to portraiture, but had to do with painting of landscape, still life, etc. So in a certain sense, the change in portraiture simply reflects a larger condition. I think that there were also specific ideas about what the truth of human nature was, what the core essence of a personality was, for example, that impelled artists to go beyond the appearance of a person and to seek out something beyond appearance as a representation of his nature that had to do specifically with human interaction, and that specifically focused in the portraiture.
Now, somewhere in one of the articles or in the catalog, I read something about the effect of Freud's studies on portraiture. Would you be a little more specific about that?
Well, I think at the end of the 19th century, there was an idea of studying people's individual quirks, the things that had previously been ignored, the whole idea of the Freudian slip, the telltale gesture. The idea of studying the personal idiosyncrasies of a twitch, of a gesture, of a particular pose as a route to understanding the formation of this personality, understanding the root, a base of this personality. And that's, most easily seen, the Freudian emphasis on the individual as having something to do with late 19th century portraiture. However, in the long run, the Freudian interest in symbolism, in the depth of association of symbol with content, may later have affected a move away from specifically representational portraiture, away from dealing with particular idiosyncrasies and eventually leading into larger psychic interpretations on a symbolic level. I don't think that Freud's or the Freudian thinking, in general psychological thinking, has one simple impact on the representation of human beings.
One rather specific, perhaps superficial, influence of Freud on portraiture that I found in dealing with Kokoschka, who was painting in Vienna during the pioneering years of psychoanalysis, was that a lot of Kokoschka's portraits were actually seen as being almost equivalents to a psychoanalytic session. People looked at his portraits as though they had stripped away the superficial or the conventional aspects of people, of which everyone in Vienna was very much aware, since there was, on the one hand, a very highly defined social etiquette, and yet a sense of alienation among many intellectuals and artists. And when Kokoschka's portraits were first displayed, they were really seen as being a sort of almost a microscope of the soul.
Could you relate that to the specific work that's
in the Knight Errant?
The Knight Errant, which is the Guggenheim's
yes.
Knight Errant.
Well, this is a picture that Kokoschka, it's a self-portrait, of course, of himself as a knight in armor stretched out on the ground. He seems to be wounded, or at least in some state of extreme agony. It's related to his own situation at the time, a very disastrous love affair that he'd had with Alma Mahler, the wife of the composer, and also his own prescience, really, about what was to happen to himself during the war, which had just begun. It was painted in 1915, just on the eve of his own departure for the front. It just can be, in purely the visual impact of the picture is one of the agony of a sensitive person, but it also it has a highly complex symbolic language, which is very similar, really, to the Freudian search for concrete symbols, which somehow embody states of the soul. And the picture was meant to be not only a testament to his own position at the time, both inwardly as well as vis-a-vis his the society in which he felt trapped, but also it expresses his own ability, at least as he felt and as other people felt, to see into the future. He actually believed that he had inherited clairvoyant powers from his mother. And so the picture is also a mystical statement, too.
How do you relate his technique to this psychological portrait? You know, it's if you would describe it for our audience,
turbulent brush strokes.
Yes.
Yeah, the picture almost seems to have been worked in an extreme state of nervous energy, a sort of almost a violence.
It's a very agitated.
It's very agitated brushwork, and the colors are very, very intense and yet cold. It's a very brooding, almost nightmarish picture. But of course, it shows a development in his own style as well. His earliest portraits, the ones which were first hailed as being the sort of analyses of a soul, were done in a very fine, linear, nervous style, quite different from the rather broad technique of the Knight Errant, which almost looked like a nervous system almost projected onto the surface of the body. Lots of quivering little lines, all the veins and the capillaries have come to the surface with the concomitant sense of tension. But in this later one, there is a greater breadth to it, which seems to indicate a change in his own outlook as well, from preoccupation with a single individual to the place of the individual amid a larger situation, or the cosmic problems which he saw, the whole problem of a major crisis in Western civilization, which he saw that the war is representing.
I'd like to switch gears a little bit and talk about another aspect of portraiture, the constraints that were imposed by the commission portrait. The payment of money for a portrait were to a large extent lifted in the late 19th and 20th century. How did this affect the artist's attitude and his techniques?
Well, I'm sure commission portraits continued to be produced. It's just that we tried to steer clear of them. You know, the last thing we wanted was Hurd's portrait of Lyndon Johnson, and this sort of idea, or the innumerable.
I didn't mean to imply that they were no longer done. However, you know, in earlier times, they were by and large commissioned either by a wealthy patron or by the church, and this is no longer the case to such an extent.
Well, again, this is just representative of a larger phenomenon that occurs steadily throughout the 19th century: the establishment of the artist as an independent who produces independently on his own without commission. Portraiture, previously the idea of a commission portrait, of course, meant that it had to satisfy the man. Normally, one's presumed that it had to satisfy the man who commissioned it, and thus he had a certain control over what happened. However, when you have non-commissioned portraiture, it's done because the artist wants to do it, and there are fewer restraints upon him to flatter the person whom he portrays. And often this means that the people that he's dealing with are people who are his intimates or who are close to him, instead of some foreign soul who wanders into the studio and pays X dollars.
I think that's an exaggeration of past portraiture, because one is not really sure to what extent patrons sought out particular artists to do their portraits. But in the Renaissance, there is an establishment of different kinds of styles, and styles do acquire their own particular meaning and their own particular following. So that I think the issues become much clearer in the 20th century, where there is a sharp demarcation between the patron and the painter, whereas in the Renaissance, perhaps that relationship is much closer and therefore much harder to judge as well.
There is a change of subject matter as well. It seems to me that artists didn't paint each other as much as they do now.
It does seem to be a recurrent phenomenon in the 20th century that you have a new, but that could be a bias of this exhibition, since we tried our best to get portraits of other artists and people in the art world, so that this exhibition is, in a sense, a slanted view in that regard. There are portraits in the past of artists by other artists, but since portraiture in the past tends to be dominated by commissioned work, and since artists rarely enjoyed the kind of status to commission portraits of themselves, what one tends to find more frequently in the past, I think, are self-portraits rather than portraits of artists by artists, though certainly they do exist and always have.
Portraits within larger paintings, that often happens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, but a donor figure in a religious scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In what way do these works differ from earlier works? And I want to quote the catalog now. They say, it reflects certain common concerns of our time.
Well, I wrote that sentence. I suppose I should be held accountable for it. I thought that looking through the exhibition, one would come up against certain ideas of perhaps not entirely reassuring ideas about alienation from the self, for example, about dissociation between the body and the spirit, about a lack of confidence in the material forms of the world, etc., that seemed to be predominant strains in 20th century thought, that these were represented in the way artists and sitters interacted and the way artists looked at themselves.
There's an alienation often between the actual material used in these portraits and then the means to which they are applied, as in, say, the Surrealist portraits, where you often have the most prosaic commercial elements, say, cut out pictures from printed catalogs of, as in Max Ernst's portraits, and then made into a very surreal, chaotic vision of what his life or his view of life is like. It's very very funny and very pointed.
Well, let me again quote the catalog, because the question of resemblance in portraiture, of course, is very important. One, most people think of a portrait as being something that resembles in some way or another the sitter. And in the introduction to the catalog, you, Kirk, talk about the disdain for direct resemblance being reinforced very often by a modern pessimism about the worth and importance of the individual, further undermining the traditional bases of portrait art. Would you expand on that idea a little bit and perhaps talk about the changes in these ideas and perhaps give some examples?
Well, I really I had a particular quote in mind, in fact, when I wrote that, which is by Kokoschka and around the time of World War II. And I think with the various disasters in the 20th century, of which we've all been made acutely aware, first World War I, World War II, the whole experience of Nazi Germany, there's been a very profound pessimism about human nature, about the worth of the individual or the power or effectiveness of an individual. And thus the idea of a portrait, which traditionally in the past has been dedicated to ennobling or making clear that X person is important, this idea no longer seems as compelling or as convincing, that a great power to change or a great quality of the ideal resides in a single human being. And I think that there's been a kind of cynicism or a reticence about the ennobling or glorifying power of the portrait that's changed the tone of this kind of
individual. And there's a loss of faith in the ability to depend upon any viewer as finding the same meaning in the external world as the artist. The loss of faith in religious structures or in political structures all are tied up in the loss of a belief in concrete meanings associated with concrete objects. And I think there's perhaps a new search for meaning in the individual, since everything external was often seen as having been discredited. And surrealism, of course, is closely related to a loss of belief that a single value can be attached to a single recognizable thing.
I would say that one of the few exceptions to that in the show is one of our earliest works by Mondrian, in which he was undergoing a very spiritual crisis. He was getting linked with theosophy. And if you look at the portrait, his eyes have been enlarged and he has a very meditative inward look. And that's one of the few examples where the artist, I think, is turning to something for support, for a set of values. It contrasts with everything in the room, and it really links itself more with 19th century portraiture than the 20th.
It It's also one of the few really idealized portraits.
Yes.
It really makes him into a kind of almost
an icon, almost, yes.
Seer.
One can extend this pessimism, I think, to the social level, in that the people who normally commission these portraits, i.e. the upper class or those in power, are also the perpetrators of the disasters in this century, too. So one almost doesn't want to have a portrait. You don't want to be allied with that group at
yes,
all.
Yes, and one reason why there are so many portraits of artists by other artists is that artists saw themselves as banding together
yeah,
and
yeah.
creating
mm-hmm.
worlds
saviors,
which perhaps within their own limitations might somehow provide a more livable environment, or at least a standard of values which could be shared, since there was seen as being a loss of any mm-hmm. Values in the accepted establishment mm-hmm. to which they could ally themselves.
I'd like to discuss now the differences in the interaction between the sitter and the artist in the 20th century, and I'd like you to particularly relate this, as you have already done, to the portrait of Gertrude Stein, the 1906 portrait of Gertrude Stein by Picasso.
Well, I chose that because it's sort of the sort of a classic quote from Picasso in relation to the portrait of Gertrude Stein, which he reworked in the process of doing it. He put the sitter through numerous sessions, dissatisfied with the face. He eventually rubbed it out and substituted a kind of stylization based on Iberian sculpture. And when the portrait was shown, Gertrude Stein's friends all complained that there was no resemblance here. And Picasso is reputed to have said, well, everyone says she doesn't look like the portrait, but never mind, in the end she will come to look just like it. The idea being that she was going to come to resemble the picture instead of vice versa, that the picture would have a shaping influence on the way we saw her, which I think is absolutely accurate, since anyone who's ever seen Picasso's portrait always, I think, sees Gertrude Stein in this image, that he typed her. So he really, in other words, a portrait painter in the 20th century tends to, the phrase I used was to confer identity rather than to record it. He shapes an image of the sitter so strong that the sitter has to live up to it, or the sitter becomes caught by it, rather than responding passively or trying to capture something unique in the sitter's nature. Now, I think that there may have been similar instances in the past. I just think that this comes to the surface as the prime rule of 20th century.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but before we leave the air, I would like to remind our audience that this exhibition remains on view until November 27th. The gallery is open daily except Sunday, and the hours are 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. Wildenstein Galleries are at 19 East 64th Street, and also there is an excellent catalog written by Professor Varnado and the three students who are with us today, and it is available and it is available for $8. And now I'd like to thank Professor Kirk Varnado, Pat Ciaffa, Doug Brenner, and Janet Parks for having been with us this evening. And to our audience, good night and thank you. Without your support, WNYC may not be able to continue operating as it has until now. If you enjoy hearing talks on art and artists, won't you help WNYC continue bringing these programs? A tax-deductible contribution of $20 or more makes you a charter member of WNYC. Send your checks to WNYC, the Municipal Building, New York, New York, 10007. The check should be made payable to WNYC. Please help us bring you the programs you enjoy. That address once again is WNYC, Municipal Building, New York, New York, 10007. Thank you.